Welcome to another Hank Unplugged podcast. This is the, well, the laid-back version of Hank. This is where I'm in my study as opposed to being in my studio, at least in terms of my disposition. It's laid back, it's less didactic, and the goal of this podcast, as every other podcast I do, is to bring the most interesting and influential people on the planet to you so that you can listen to their perspective, learn from their perspective, and so that we can all grow together and be more effective. And this is particularly true for Christians listening in to the podcast. We want to make a difference while there is yet time. I'm staring my own mortality in the face, and as you do that, you become more aware of the fact that every moment is sacred, every moment is important. And today, I'm just so glad to have Mindy Bells with us on the podcast. She's influenced me in many ways. I mean, I've been reading her articles for many years. I've been very, very infatuated with her book, They Say We Are Infidels, On the Run from ISIS with Persecuted Christians in the Middle East. Mindy is an extraordinary person. She's a senior editor at World Magazine. She's been a writer for World since 1986. And she has discovered so many things as she has covered war all over the world, in the Balkans, Sudan, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan. And she, quite frankly, has incredible courage. I mean, she's going behind the lines so that we might better, as Christians, understand the plight of Christians around the world. I can add to the list Nigeria and Egypt and Turkey. And her reporting has been published all over the place. She's been on television, in print, on radio, on podcasts like this. And I want to start out with something, Mindy, that's probably a little off track. But, I mean, here you are, a woman. You have kids. And I know you've taken a lot of heat from people that write you and say, woman with kids, a husband, what are you doing going behind the lines, putting your life in danger? Why not just stay in the home? Your response to that?
Yeah, I mean, my kids are grown now, which is a great blessing. But I was traveling, and you know, and around the time of 9/11, when I was traveling a lot to Iraq and then later to Afghanistan, my kids were ranging in age from elementary school up to high school, with one about to go to college. And I would get letters from time to time from people, and usually it was women who would, you know, quote scripture to me and remind me that my place is in the home. And I, you know, partly I took those to heart, but I think we're all subject to, you know, under the Lord's headship is the headship of other people in our lives. And I had two wonderful editors over me and a wonderful husband alongside of me who I relied on for guidance. And we all had a sense that this was a calling I felt and a calling that they could accommodate and encourage. And so I continued to do it. And I will say this too, Hank, that there's something really wonderful about being able as a woman to step into a society, a Muslim-dominated society that tends to be very oppressive to women. And I found that, I mean, early on I had encounters where I realized, you know, an American walking into a room, the first thing we do is we stick out our hand to shake the hand of someone that we're meeting for the first time. You can't do that in Muslim society. And I was responding that way and finding that, you know, men were literally recoiling from me because they just simply do not touch a woman who's not their wife or their sister. So I had a lot of awkward moments where I was learning. But one of the things that I learned out of that was that I had a unique opportunity. I was not privileged to be in some of the men's circles, but a unique opportunity to be in the women's circles and to see things from a woman's perspective. And that's, you know, one reason that as I got toward writing the book, one of the principal characters in that book is an Iraqi Christian woman named Insaf Safu. I flew into Baghdad with Insaf, and this amazing relationship and adventure began. And that was because I was going with a woman and not going with a mayor or a city councilman or some power figure. And I was getting a different perspective, and in some ways it was richer, in some ways I think it was an important perspective.
And when you have been traveling around the world, what do you think today is the most significant or maybe problematic place in the world? You look at the most dangerous places in the world, and typically at the top of the list you have North Korea, and then invariably the rest of the countries are Islamic countries. You've written about North Korea. What is your perspective on North Korea, on how we're handling the North Korean situation?
Well, I think it's really tricky. And, you know, I don't know that our president's tweets and sort of offhand statements and statements that seem to sort of ratchet up the tension, I don't know that that's helpful. Having said that, I think that we're facing somewhat of an inevitable crisis with North Korea. We've been walking toward this for at least a decade, where we saw that they were gradually acquiring the capabilities of two things: making a nuclear bomb of some sort, and also improving their missile capability, which primarily they've been able to do through regimes like Iran and to some extent Syria even. And we watched them doing that, and we knew that our choices were pretty grim, that we had to keep talking and keep negotiating, keep accommodating that, or we had to attack them because the regime was not backing down. And attacking them would instantly mean, by all kinds of military experts and various military scenarios, possibly 1 million casualties. You know, immediately they would respond by attacking South Korea. The geography, the proximity of these high density urban areas there have just made it a really problematic situation. I don't know, honestly, that we're in a different place right now. We still face really tough prospect if we are to attack North Korea. But I don't think that we can tolerate forever, not in some way, moving the dial to force their hand a little bit. And forcing their hand carries great risk. And so in one sense, I wonder sometimes if, you know, President Trump isn't, as much as I haven't liked his rhetoric, is it maybe, you know, in some ways playing a game that might ultimately be the kind of game that North Korea might respond to, that they might actually take something off the table if they truly, truly think that the United States is about to attack them. Very, very tough. What I will say in the midst of it is that one of the remarkable stories to me, and this gets to your question about toughest places in the world, one of the most remarkable things to me about North Korea is that while all of this headline-grabbing tension has been going on, there have been about 200 Americans working in North Korea, most of them American Christians, evangelical Christians, who are there because of an incredible commitment to the people of North Korea, to wanting to serve them with medicine and food and education primarily. And I've spent some time, because they all had to leave a few weeks ago and they're hoping that they're going to be able to go back. But I've spent some time talking to some of them, and their commitment to the people and their commitment now, in spite of greater risk than has been there before, is really remarkable. And that's what I find everywhere. Like when you say, what's the hardest place in the world? Hardest place in the world maybe perhaps is the human heart, because we know that sin and evil are running through all of our hearts, and that therefore anywhere you go is going to be a hard place. I find some of the cities of Europe, you know, I've spent a lot of time the last 2 years in Brussels, for instance, which people think is going to become the first Muslim majority city in Europe in about 20 years, if not sooner. And I find parts of Brussels to be really, really hard. And because you have this incredible vacuum created by secularism there. And then you have Islam moving into that vacuum. And it's frightening. And then I find some of the other places that you mentioned also, you know, Nigeria is a place where violence has just exploded in the last 5 years. And the way that Boko Haram has been able to terrorize people unchecked has been just remarkable. But then we have, you know, similar conflicts happening in Central African Republic is one we don't hear much about. Just horrific, horrific atrocities there. Congo, a war that's been going on now, Africa's longest war. And then, of course, you know, the one that is probably one that I've followed most closely, one that we've heard about, one that has huge implications for the United States is the civil war in Syria, which I never thought I would see something unravel quite so fast and quite so horrifically as it has in Syria. Syria was a beautiful country, lots of history, really amazing ancient Christian sites, as well as Jewish sites and Muslim sites, many of those that have been destroyed now. Some of the oldest marketplaces and city, you know, the center, old city of Aleppo was a World Heritage Site that was just unparalleled in the world, had a citadel from the Crusader era, an incredible marketplace surrounding it. Very happy place, actually, in the Middle East until this war began, and now it has pretty much been destroyed. So those would be some of my hard places. But again, I always find that the church is at work in the hardest places, and that makes an incredible difference.
I want to sort of circle back to what you were saying at the beginning when you're talking about the courage of Christians in North Korea. I still remember being in Dubai and having to indemnify an airline so that I could fly from Dubai to Tehran. And suddenly it struck me, wow, maybe I'm putting myself in a whole lot more danger than I should be putting myself into. Maybe I'm being far too cavalier. And I suppose in a small way, that experience is your experience. I mean, you've traveled all over the Middle East and you've gone behind the lines, as it were. You've put your life in danger. And now you mention the courage of these Christians who were working in North Korea, left North Korea, and want to go back, and particularly at this very, very dangerous time in human history in places like North Korea and the other places that we talked about. I think speaking to those listening in right now about the courage that we need to have as Christians, recognizing that our life is a vapor here today, gone tomorrow, that the courage of the early Christian church is what spread the gospel around the world. It's the blood of the martyrs that becomes the seed of the church and so forth. Talk about that courage and why we cannot be wilting flowers in the face of the current conditions worldwide.
Well, I think that the gospel, if we really understand the rescue that it is for each of us individually, and then the power of the gospel and how the power that it has to transform society, and we can, you know, we know that that's true in our heads. We can look back at history and see that it's true in fact. When we look at the Reformation, when we look at perhaps the development of, say, Western Europe coming out of the Reformation. And when we look at even the founding of the United States and how much gospel teaching fueled the growth of America, fueled the economy of America, and the way that people understood that, you know, understood that the free exchange of ideas and the free exchange of our economic system, you know, that trusting the market, if you will, all of those things, at base are rooted in this idea that at the end of the day, God wins. At the end of the day, God is the one who holds up the universe. And that gives us tremendous power and hope, I think. And I think people who really get a sense of that and also feel a calling into hard places, obviously it's not for all of us, and sometimes the hardest places beside a hospital bed, or, you know, we all have different kinds of hard places in our lives. But for those who feel a calling to a place like North Korea, they go because they know that God has it. They know that at the end of the day, He is the one who's ultimately in control. Heidi Linton is one of the people that I talked to about her work in North Korea. She was actually the last American to leave when the Trump administration's travel restrictions on North Korea came in. She hopes to get an exemption to those and be able to go back. There's a provision for that, but it's a little bit of a process. So she was the last American to come out at the end of August, just before the new rules went into effect September 1. And she, you know, it's like her 54th trip there or something. She's been working there for 20 years. And what she said is, these are end of the road places where we work. And they are literally hard to get to, but they are also places that no one steps into if we don't. And it's just that kind of, that's the heart of that courage that you're asking about, I think, is that people recognize no one else is going to do this. I don't really have much to be afraid of because I know that God is before me, God is behind me, God is around me, and I know that He's calling us to serve these people. So I think it's both a obvious help, a practical help. They are Heidi Linton's group, Christian Friends of Korea. Interestingly, they use Christian in their name. The regime knows that they're Christians. They're not doing outright evangelism because the regime would forbid that. But what they are doing is providing water systems, and they're running some immunization programs. They're helping with tuberculosis, which is very involved treatment program. They're involved in that, and they just recognize that they're providing a service, and they also are providing a witness as they are that otherwise you would not have in a place like North Korea right now.
I want to sort of pan back and look at what's going on in the world in general. You have many different countries. You mentioned some of the EU countries that are becoming Islamic demographically and inevitably going to become Islamic politically as well. I mean, that's the natural ramification of the demographics. But what I find to be, well, strange, I suppose, on the one hand, but really troubling is that it seems to me that most people in the West are now buying into a narrative that Islam is a religion of peace and tolerance, that Christianity is a crusader religion, and therefore there seems to be this unhealthy alliance between a liberals and between illicit Islam, because Christianity is the one force that must be dominated or the one force that must be eradicated. And that has ramifications not only with respect to the soft persecution of Christians in the West, but also with respect to the fact that the persecution of Christians in the East is squarely in the blind spot of the West.
Right. We definitely see it, and I guess I think one of the ways that we sort of counter it is just by what I was describing. We counter it by continuing to do the work that God calls us to and continuing to be a witness in spite of both the soft persecution and the hard persecution. Easy to say that, hard to do it. I mean, one of the recent examples that comes to mind as you were talking is we've had a situation in Iraq now for 3 years since ISIS invaded the middle of the country very forcibly, very violently, with obvious premeditation, pushed the Yazidi people and the Christian people, the non-Muslim populations of Iraq, out of their homelands. You have all sorts of bodies around the world who have declared that a genocide. We now have a situation where militarily the area has been liberated from ISIS. Very, very few of the people there have been allowed to return home. And what's shocking, what's truly shocking, because we have millions of dollars going into Iraq. I mean, you and I could spend a whole hour talking about all the different ways that American federal dollars are going into Iraq right now. None of it has reached the Christians who were displaced by ISIS. And I say that, like, I normally would want to be really careful before I said it, but that's true. The people living in displaced camps have been supported by Catholic and Protestant relief groups for these 3 years. They are now looking at tremendous need to repair infrastructure in their homes in order to go back. There is plenty of money flowing into Iraq, but the humanitarian aid money that could be used to help them is going in through the UN, and the UN is not applying it to their areas, to their particular villages. We should be doing it ourselves, and not jimmying around with UN bureaucracy, and we aren't. And it seems to me that's a place where we have a great strategic interest. We have an obligation to our men and women in the military who fought there, not to make their fighting there in vain. And we have an obligation to the Iraqi people, because we came in and we invaded their country, and they have suffered tremendously as fallout from that invasion. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, you have a tremendous humanitarian crisis that has unfolded in just the last few weeks in Myanmar or Burma, where the Burmese army has been forcing out of their homes Rohingya Muslims, a very specific ethnic religious group that has been highly persecuted. Christians have also been highly persecuted in Myanmar. But they have run hundreds of thousands of them out of their homes in the last week. And the State Department gave them $32 million last week without hardly a blink of an eye, very easily. And I think it gets at what you're talking about. In the bureaucracies of the U.S. government, as well as we see in our educational institutions, we see with media, we see many of our cultural institutions, it is very acceptable to help a Muslim or a Buddhist or a Hindu persecuted minority. And I don't want to at all make light of the fact that they are being persecuted, because I think that is the case here with Burma. And there have been real atrocities there. But to quickly come to their aid while for 3 years not coming to the aid of Christians in Iraq is the most blatant example I know of what our ideas are about Christianity and about Islam. What we do about that, it's a hard question. And I think, I'll speak frankly that I expected the Trump administration, I expected the State Department under Secretary of State Rex Tillerson to do more than they've done. They are allowing a bias to continue there that is very much an Obama-era bias. And it's puzzling. It's strange. I don't know why that's happening. But it is a problem that I think we will need to attack straight on, and showing from history and showing the realities on the ground that Christianity, for the most part, is not a crusader religion, and is something that helps people instead of harms people. And then we will have to continue to exhibit that indeed as well. And I see that happening all the time. I see the church being the church in the hardest places. I see the way that Christians in Iraq have cared not only for one another, but have cared for Muslims who've been displaced and have cared for Yazidis who've been displaced. And I think we will have to keep doing that. And in some ways, leave the story up to the Lord and pray and work toward His, making it clear who His people are and what it is that they stand for.
Yeah, beautifully said. I love the cover of your book. They say we are infidels. There's the noon at the very top of the book. And I want you to talk to people a little bit about what that represents. I actually wear that on my lapel, so a lot of people will ask me about it. This really represents the solidarity that you and I have in standing with people who are Christians all over the world, but particularly in the Middle East, who have had their homes, their churches taken away, who have seen that symbol on their home. So for us, it's a statement of solidarity for ISIS and other Muslim groups. It is a term of derision.
That's right. And it has become, as you say, a symbol of solidarity for others. The noon is simply, you know, in the Islamic alphabet, which is very different from our own, but it is the sound or the letter N. It would be equivalent to, and in Arabic, it has been used to symbolize Nasariya, which is Nazarene, is where the word is coming from, and what a term that Muslims often use for Christians. It's a descriptive term, but it has come to be something of a term used as a mocking term, particularly by groups like ISIS. When ISIS came into Mosul and they chased the Christians out of the neighborhoods where Christians had dominated, you know, really back almost to the time of Christ, after they emptied their homes, they went through and spray painted. I've seen a number of these. They spray painted the Nun on the corner of the house. They wanted it to be known that these had been houses of Christians. They often came back and desecrated the homes. They would also spray paint slogans for jihadism below them. They came back and sometimes bulldozed the homes, sometimes just, I've seen houses where they went through, it looks like they went through and sprayed oil on the inside of the house like you would from a gasoline tank or a propane tank or something, sprayed a kind of oil or a kind of flammable liquid, and then they torched them. And so the houses are still standing to some extent, but they're completely uninhabitable. And the noon has just come to symbolize basically how ISIS has made the Christians suffer. I think it's interesting that we in the West and a number of Christians in the Middle East have taken it up as a symbol of solidarity, as you say, in a way of standing with them, because the Christians actually came to wear it proudly. And it's really important, Hank, to underscore that, because many of us, you know, I think if I were in the same shoes and I were forced at gunpoint to leave my home and leave everything behind, what would I do next? I might be tempted to go and hide somewhere. I might be tempted to just get away from my Christian brothers and sisters because they would endanger me. Staying with them would endanger. And this has not been the response of these Christians at all. They have stuck together. I was at a worship service early this year where I expected there to be several hundred people. This was in northern Iraq, an area where many of the displaced Christians have been living. I know how hard that life is for them, and I expect them to be discouraged. And there were, when I got to the church, the double doors of the church were wide open. People were standing on the landing, the portico of the church. People were standing out in the courtyard. You couldn't get everyone in. There were easily 1,000 people for this one church service. People were standing on their tiptoes. They wanted to see the front and see what was going on. They stand together. They're not afraid to be seen together. They're not afraid to be known by the symbol, and basically to count themselves worthy of suffering for Christ, and that's a powerful lesson.
It's interesting that you say that. I remember you talking about this in a broadcast I did with you, as well as reading this in your book, and maybe I'll set this up this way. I think Yaroslav Pelikan once said that tradition is the living faith of the dead. Traditionalism is the dead faith of the living. and it is traditionalism that gives tradition such a bad name. And the reason I bring it up this way is because a lot of Western Christians look at Eastern Christians and they say, you know what? These are Christians that are mired in sort of a tradition that has little to do with evangelicalism in the West, and therefore they're not really Christians at all. They're following a dead liturgy. They don't have a vibrant faith. And I think you've found that that is not exactly how it is.
Right. I mean, that was my own presupposition when I started going to Iraq. You know, I went to Iraq for the first time in 2002. We all kind of knew that a war with Iraq was coming. I was in the Middle East. I was actually in Syria and had the opportunity to go there. And I went, you know, and mostly spent time with the Kurds and some Arabs during that time. I don't know that I encountered any Iraqi Christians on that first trip. When I went back after the war started, it was, as I mentioned, with the Iraqi Christian named Insaf Safu. But I was going because she was an Iraqi who was returning, and I wanted to see what Iraq looked like to her through her eyes. I, you know, to my shame now, I admit, I was not going because she was a Christian. I did not have a clue, really, of what this Christian population in the Middle East actually looked like. And I think that was because I was reading things through my own Western lens. I mean, for me, as someone who was born into the Methodist Church and later became a believer through Baptist Church and other organizations, Campus Crusade, Bible study, things like that, I had an idea of sort of the old denominations in the United States being the dead ones, being, you know, associating them with dead religion. And I think as a result, that's what I thought of when I thought of the old churches in the Middle East. There's a really interesting history there, particularly with Iraq and some of the other countries of the Middle East that, in fact, you know, they split off from the church in Rome early on after the time of Christ's death and resurrection. And they became very isolated. This was over a theological dispute over the nature of Christ. They were, some of them attended the Council of Nicaea in 325, where the Nicene Creed was written. Some of them were booted from it, not welcomed there. They became a very isolated church, and they remained that way in some cases into the late 20th century. The Chaldean church, for the most part, was not reunited with the Catholic Church in Rome, even though that its traditions, its liturgy were all very similar to the Catholic Church. It did not come back into, let's say, fellowship with Rome until the early 1990s. And so one of the beautiful things about this isolation and this division, if you want to call it that, is that the church sort of preserved itself as it was very much cut off from some of the modern liberalizing things that we have seen work destruction in the Western church. And so when I finally started actually worshiping with Iraqi Christians, actually attending their services, I was so surprised. And when I sat down with some of the bishops, I had a very memorable breakfast one morning with the Syrian Orthodox Bishop of Aleppo, a man who was kidnapped and killed early on in the war. But he basically, I said, tell me your story. And what he did was he told me his testimony, told me what Christ meant to him and what the gospel meant to him. And I was so struck with how it would be what he was saying is something that we would consider an evangelical testimony in the United States. And I was hearing it from someone who could trace his church tradition back to the second and third century.
I think this is one of the problems, Mindy. I mean, I think that I sometimes talk about biblical literacy, but I think we have an attendant problem, and it is the fact that we are historically illiterate as well. So often we do not know the history of the Christian church, and as a result of that, we have prejudices that divide us as opposed to becoming an opportunity for uniting us. There's so many things that you've talked about that I want to touch on. I suppose I want to get back to Burma or Myanmar. I spent a fair amount of time in Yangon and other places in Myanmar. And a lot of people in the West, and even in places like South Korea in the East, see this as an opportunity to be a replica of what happened in South Korea. South Korea was a military state for a long time, and now it is this thriving capitalistic democracy, and many, many people are investing in Myanmar thinking that the same thing could happen there, that Christianity could really thrive there. And so they're building businesses there and investing capital there. And yet, as you point out, there is a tremendous amount of bigotry against various religions and a way in which people are trying to convert by sword as opposed to propagating the faith by word. Maybe you can talk about that sort of macro issue. Christianity is a religion that is not a crusader religion. It advances by word and not by sword. And to the extent that it does advance by sword, it is in direct conflict with the worldview that Christ gave us.
Right. Well, I think that the situation in Myanmar has been one that's been going on for a long time. And even though we have seen, you know, we restored relations with the military junta that's ruling there after they agreed to hold elections and to elect a parliament. We saw Aung San Suu Kyi, the longtime opposition leader, actually become a leader in that country and a member of parliament with full standing. And these are remarkable developments. And I think, as you said, we all hoped that we would be seeing some kind of transition along the lines of what happened in South Korea 60 plus years ago. But we weren't invested in the same way. We were sort of cheering from the sidelines. We weren't, as a country, as our own military, as our own our humanitarian apparatus, we weren't investing. And I look at what we did in South Korea, which is really a remarkable example, the way that we came in. We provide, you know, we had 30 and 40,000 soldiers on the ground there following the Korean War. That's a presence that has continued to this day. It might be a little bit lower than that right now, but we still have a very strong military presence there. We don't talk about that. We don't debate about that. And yet, you know, we debate about putting 10,000 more soldiers in Afghanistan. And I don't know that we have to have a full-on military presence, but it takes that to affect and support the kinds of changes that we're talking about, the big picture that you're talking about. So we don't have a military investment in Myanmar. We don't. Another thing we did in South Korea is that American businessmen, British businessmen were really encouraged to come in and to work alongside some of the fledgling businesses that were getting started in South Korea after the Korean War. Those businesses have become Samsung, they've become LG, they've become, you know, names that are on your cars and your refrigerators. And that's because they had a real early on heavy lift investment. It's going to take that. And in this country, we seem to get really bogged down in political debates that assume that we're doing too much. We can't be the world's policeman. That's something you always hear by those who don't want to make those kinds of investments. Well, the other side of it is that it seems like to me, it's more a question of when are we going to be the world's policeman? Are we going to be it early on when we can make really positive investments that will help to get these countries standing on their feet and give individuals real freedom? Or are we going to come in and be the world's policeman at the end of the day when instead they have hatched oppressive governments that have grown jihadist groups that have begun attacking the West again, and we find that we have to go in and do mop-up operations? I just think that that's where we are in the world right now, that we, the United States, have really pulled back in the kind of engagement, the kind of involvement that we did post-World War II, post-Korean War. And instead, we are trying to do kind of piecemeal things that don't, frankly, seem to be working very well.
And to that point, I mean, I think that if, for example, George Bush would have understood that state is Sharia and Sharia is state, he might have had a different perspective on how difficult it would be, if not impossible, to impose democracy in Iraq. I mean, it seems like this is a non sequitur. It seems if we understand what Islam is about and not just buy into a cultural narrative, I think we would be a whole lot more effective in our foreign policy.
Yes. I also think, I mean, that's another point where when I hear people say Islam and democracy are non sequitur, I say yes and no to that, because I think, I actually think I probably agree with George Bush, George W. Bush on this, you know, that the democracy and the desire to be free and the desire to live out the beliefs in your heart, that's something that is in everyone. And as I have spent time with Muslims in Iraq and Muslims in other places, many of them do long for something better. They recognize that they are the subject to cruel, oppressive governments, and that Islam, you know, as practiced by those governments, is making their lives worse. And I'm not necessarily not disagreeing with the idea that Islam, I mean, at the end of the day, Islam is not a religion of peace. And so that's the problem that we deal with. But there are a couple of things that have happened. You know, Turkey lived for all of its problems until we had the crackdowns that have come in under President Erdogan. Turkey was basically a functioning democracy. And I look back at the situation in Iraq, and we made a very strategic error in 2005, 2006, when we helped the Iraqis write a constitution. We did the very same thing in Afghanistan. All the blood and treasure, all the combat, all the sacrifice to get to this point, we helped them write a constitution. We were holding the keys at that point, and we allowed them to write constitutions that enshrine Sharia law in the first, I believe it's Article 3 or 4, of the Iraq Constitution, and similarly in the Afghan Constitution. We allowed them to do that. And there are plenty of, I believe, of Muslims who would wish that Sharia law were not enshrined as the law of the land. And certainly enshrining Sharia law as the law of the land is not a good thing for the non-Muslims who live in Iraq. And they were making a case to the U.S. government that this did not represent them and it was undemocratic, and we turned a deaf ear to that. I sat in a meeting at the State Department with two church leaders, meeting with a number of people around the table who had been working on Iraq issues at the State Department. The people at the State Department were shocked when these people told them in very forceful tones that the Iraq Constitution denied them their basic human freedoms and basic individual rights. And there's really no excuse for that to me.
You know, interesting perspective, maybe in a broader sense. I mean, you talk about what happened in Turkey. Ataturk actually called the Muslim religion the immoral religion of a dead Arab. And so he wanted to completely dismantle the whole idea of Sharia. I suppose the broader point that I was trying to make is that Christ made plain that there is a distinction between state and religion. Given to Caesar, that which is Caesar's. Given to God, that which is God's. But in Sharia, as I mentioned before, Sharia is state and state is Sharia. So in other words, they're incompatible. But I guess the point that you're making, which is a point well taken, is you can have Muslim countries under counter-revolutionaries like Ataturk, you can have them switch to a democratic form of government. And unfortunately now, you seem to be alluding to, and this is my perspective as well, the hardliners in Turkey are reverting back to the hard line of Sharia and Islam.
And they do that by upending democratic institutions. Erdogan would not be doing what he's doing in Turkey, except that he declared a state of emergency, turned out the democratically elected parliament. And I guess, you know, I'm not saying any of this is easy or that it's easy to snap our fingers and have things go the right way. But I don't think we have to institute, let's say, Christian law, or that we have to become sort of militant Christians about all of this. I think we simply have to uphold our democratic institutions. And I fear, I mean, that is the problem that Europe is facing. I fear it is the problem that the United States will face at some point, that Europe has become very dependent on a regulatory system of government, that the EU has become very bureaucratic, very, bending over backwards to try not to discriminate against its Muslim people. Well, how about we uphold our democratic institutions and the law and order that undergirds those? Therefore, we don't allow Muslims to violate existing laws in the same way that we don't allow other people to violate them. And so, therefore, Sharia law is not going to be something that's tolerated except where it accords with existing democratic institutions. I think that there are ways that we should love our democracy enough and love the freedom that it has given us to express our own deeply held beliefs, to uphold it in a way that Islam wants to threaten it, if that's maybe a better way of saying it. And it's very complicated, but the alternatives are much more complicated, and we have watched. In the last 10 years, what's happened in Iraq as a result of enshrining Sharia law in the constitution, given rise to these very hardline Islamic parties, the weakness that we've seen in the Iraq army and the Iraq government that has allowed them not to step in and protect because they have these hardline Muslim parties breathing down their necks. And so there was no protection ever for the non-Muslims living in Iraq, when they should have had a constitution after the ouster of Saddam Hussein. They should have had a constitution that protected everyone.
I'm thinking about what happened back in the 7th century, where Muhammad orders all infidels to be driven from the Arabian Peninsula, and the fact that today you have the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia saying it's necessary to destroy every single church in the whole of the Arabian Peninsula. And I bring that up, particularly with your background and your travels. It seems like when you have the Grand Mufti of one of our allies making that kind of a statement, it seems like that would be front page news. I mean, that would be something that we would be talking about. And yet, for the most part, it seems to me that not only secularists, but Christians are just yawning.
Yes. In a lot of quarters, they are, and I think that speaks to the weakness of the church and the weakness of our Christian witness in public life in the West, in Europe, in the United States. Europe and the United States are in very different places right now, but I think we are prone to that, and Islam will come in and fill in any vacuum, and the growing secularism that takes root in communities, especially in Europe. It's just astonishing when you go into a fairly large city of Europe, and you know the churches there would be considered, I mean, having 80 or 100 people on a Sunday service would be considered a good turnout. That's a large church in most parts of Europe now. One of the things that I will say that's happening that's very heartening, and you know, that I think points to the way that God works in these situations is the number of Muslims who are coming to Christ. I was able to be at a service last summer on the outskirts of Brussels, where 9 Iraqi men gave their lives to Christ. And these were men who were from areas of Iraq that I don't believe have had Christians living in them for centuries. Places like Fallujah. One was from Ur, where Abraham was from, near Baghdad. And they gave their lives to Christ, and I was able to see actually 2 of them a year later, just this past summer, very much a part of an Arab evangelical church in Belgium, very happy with their conversions. And I'm hearing these stories everywhere I go, and I wasn't hearing them, say, 5 years ago. The upheaval, the turmoil created by ISIS, the mass migration that we've seen happen across the Mediterranean for all its problems. One of these gentlemen said to me, when I finally made it to Europe, I asked for someone to direct me to a church. And I said, why did you want to go to a church? And he said, because Islam has been nothing but trouble for me. And I think that for a lot of Muslims, that is part of the story, that's part of where they are coming to, as we see a lot of the radicalism and the jihadism, the violence of Islam come to the fore. They are being faced with a choice. Will they continue to follow a very violent religion, or will they seek hope somewhere else? We have to be ready to give them hope. And we have to be, I'd like to think that we're kind of societies that are structured for that, and where the church isn't hard to find. The church in Europe is hard to find, and I sure would hate to see that happen in the United States.
Yeah, you know, we talk so often about preserving our way of life, and when you look at what is going on with respect to our way of life in the West, it seems as though the Christian underpinnings are still there. I mean, we, however, are no longer living in the pages of the Bible. We're living really from the benefits of Western culture, but we are far from it. And I think this is true not only with respect to what I spoke about earlier when I spoke about a liberal liberalism, but it seems like this idea has crept into the church itself. In other words, what the culture has been preaching seems to have been inculcated in the church itself. I say that only to get your perspective on the West as well, where we're trying to preserve a way of life, but the way of life that we're trying to preserve has denigrated rapidly from the Judeo-Christian underpinnings that have been revolutionary to the world, actually, as a result of our light.
Yeah, I think that we also have to acknowledge, you know, Jesus was a radical. What Jesus was preaching and the work that he was doing was very radical in his day. And he came to upset the established order. He came to upset the established Jewish order. And he wasn't afraid to do that. And so when I think that we all, and I find the temptation myself as I get older, you know, I want things to be familiar. I want things to not change, perhaps. And yet it doesn't seem to correspond to the gospel and correspond to the kind of life that Jesus calls us to. But it's radical to what end? And hopefully, if we pursue change, if we pursue if we're walking in step with what he is doing in the world and with a kingdom that I think God is creating, that is going to be something that's maybe beyond what any of us imagine. One of the things that I see both here in this country and as I travel in other places is a new diversity and a new opportunities for people of different races and ethnicities and perhaps religious backgrounds to live side by side. I see these churches in Europe that are now being revitalized. I've talked to people in Germany who feel that their churches have been brought to life by having Iranians and Afghans and other people coming in. One person explained to me, they said, you know, our church, our services have slowed down. It used to be they were over in 50 minutes to an hour. Now the sermon is being translated into Farsi and into Arabic, and it takes three times as long to get through a service. But we love it because we needed something to shake us up. I think we have to have that mindset of sort of embracing the next thing that God is doing, not simply for the sake of change, but for the sake of other people coming to know Christ who maybe never, ever had an opportunity to before. And it's exciting to me that think that God would work through some of the hardest things in life, through terrorism, through people being displaced and made to be refugees, things like that. But that is kind of the way he works, is that he does work through hardship to establish his kingdom in greater and greater ways.
That's beautifully said. And there's a sense that I've always had about you and reading you. There's a sense of optimism, particularly about the millennial generation. Not only that, but there's a sense in which you are constantly underscoring the fact that we in the West can learn so much from our persecuted brothers and sisters in the East and, of course, in other places around the world. And that persecution does bear fruit. And just to add one thing to this, I'm just thinking out loud here that I was talking about this with Oz Guinness, and he had that same optimistic vibe that you have. He was talking about the fact that we as Christians should not see ourselves as victims, because ultimately through resurrection, we can never be a victim. No matter what, we are victors in Christ. And I want you to talk a little bit about that optimism.
Well, I think if the gospel teaches us anything, it teaches us that the battle has been won. And, you know, if I'm honest, I don't always feel that way. And I think most of us, we face challenges, whether they're in our homes, in our families, in our country, in our world, we face challenges that make us feel very much like we're in the midst of a battle. And yet, I think we always want to keep that perspective that Christ has overcome the world. And therefore, we can act and move about and make decisions in the midst of our daily battles. We can make decisions from a perspective of a victory rather than from a perspective of being defeated. And I don't know any other power quite like it, Hank, because, you know, as we get older, we find our bodies don't give us that sense of victory. We can find that the hardships of life, whether they're financial or whether they're, you know, loss in our own families or disease. I've been through all of those things on a personal level in the last few years. And so I know that I know that the things I own and I know that the family that I love, those are not going to be around forever. So what is the thing that gives us that that real and lasting victory? And the only thing I know is Jesus Christ, who has overcome all of our sin and all of our enemies. And it is tremendously freeing. I think that in this country, we can lose sight of it because the freedom is something we sort of swim in. And when you are in a place where there's no freedom to swim in, there's no free air to breathe in a sense, and your life is very confined and your choices are very confined, and you face a threat all day long from the powers that be, then you begin to see what real freedom is, and that you can have real freedom in your heart through accepting the work and the salvation of Christ. I don't know anything else that comes close.
Our brother Nabil Qureshi has gone home to be with the Lord, and I found his last few Facebook posts to be so stunning and stirring. Here's a person that is quite certain that he is on death's doorstep, speaking with such eloquence about the peace we have in Jesus Christ. And so his life was...
At age 34.
Yeah, at age 34. His life was extraordinary in so many ways. I loved his books, but I loved his Facebook posts so much as well. His Facebook lives were a glimpse into his soul. And this is a great example of a man who was a Muslim and became a Christian and died with peace in the midst of very difficult circumstances. And you knew his life. You interviewed him when he was in Dearborn, Michigan, handing out pamphlets and then arrested and all of these kinds of things. So, yeah, talk about Nabil. I mean, he's a great example of what you're talking about, the power of Christ, the power of resurrection.
Yeah, I grew so fond of Nabil and so fond of his work. And, you know, I love Amazon and its algorithms because somehow they figured out that my book should be sold alongside of Nabil's book. And he and I both emailed some and we kind of laughed about that, that, you know, that was just like such an honor to me. Nabil said something that's so important. I mean, this brave stand that he made. He never looked back. His Christianity gave him so much joy. And yet, leaving Islam meant leaving his family that was very dear to him. They did not, to my knowledge, forgive him for it. And he made that choice knowing that that was the cost that he was going to pay. He said something, though, that he said that he came to what he called a three-pronged fork in the road, where he had to choose apostasy from Islam, apathy, meaning that he would just simply quit thinking about it and not be a religious person, or radicalization, meaning that, that Islam, you know, I think he did such a good job of showing that Islam run down to its roots, down to what it really, really means, is going to make you a violent radical. And he chose to leave Islam out of recognizing the three-pronged fork in the road that he faced. But what he embraced, you know, I think those three-pronged forks can apply to us as Christians too, because we, you know, we can be sort of, in order to be Christians, we need to in some ways be apostates from the secular age that we live in, an age that wants to tell us that religious belief is for white men in wigs who lived many centuries ago, that we've outgrown that. And then the apathy, that is the choice that I see so many people making, which is, I just won't think about what happens after this life. I'll think about my comfort right now. And even in our churches, we tend to fall into that of just, there are a lot of things in our American, you know, the success that it is to live in America, a lot of comfort that can occupy us and keep us busy and keep us from thinking about the big questions. And then the radicalization, I come back to what I said about Jesus being a radical, that radicalization to Christianity, if it really, we really go to the root, and that's what Nabil did. He was a Christian radical in a lot of ways. He put aside his heritage, his family, and embraced Christ. And it was really a beautiful, beautiful thing. And he was an amazing person.
He was an amazing person. And so many people are asking the question, why? Why is a guy so gifted as a writer, so gifted as an apologist? Why in the world would God allow him to die at age 34? And yet you and I have both realized that asking the why question is not the right question. God oftentimes doesn't answer that question, but he teaches us to trust him in the midst of our whys. And I think this is not only true with respect to what you've seen in the life of Nabil, but it's true in what you have written about, and they say we are infidels. So many testimonies of lives cut short, Christians being killed that could be used we would think, in a far more advantageous sense for the gospel if they were alive. And yet,
right.
God is a God that over and over again demonstrates that we can trust him, and therefore we can rest in the fact that we don't know why Nabil has gone home. We think he could have been used very, very efficaciously in this world, but God is trustworthy.
Right. Nabil's joy and his confidence as he approached death are things that I always want to remember and want to apply in my own life. Because as you say, you know, we can tread a lot of water, we can spin a lot of wheels asking the why questions, but Nabil wasn't asking those. Nabil was really resting in what God had for him.
You know, one thing I want to touch on with you, we're getting pretty close to closing this out. You know, I led a Muslim to the Lord, and he came and lived in our home for a year. And there's a really difficult process that a Muslim has to go through, because I saw in the case of the Muslim I'm talking about, Saeed, he was separated from his family. He couldn't go back to Amman, Jordan. The decision that someone makes as a Muslim to become a Christian is, it's earth-shaking. I mean, they lose their family. He lost his family. He had no contact
right.
with his family. In fact, he told me that his family now would want him dead because
right.
of his apostasy. So this is a big, big thing. And I think that, I suppose you've underscored that as well as anyone, the fact that Muslims are coming to faith in Christ, but there is a huge sacrifice. But because of the truth of the gospel, the sacrifice is worth it.
That's right. And the freedom and the power, the freedom that they feel in casting themselves at the foot of the cross, essentially, really becoming a brother of Christ, a follower of Christ, and a child of God, the freedom for them in that is tremendous. It's unmistakable, and I think it should just remind those of us who have spent, you know, long years as Christians that, you know, we should walk with that same astonishment and joy, in a sense, that I see in some of these new Muslim converts to Christianity.
Mindy Bells, we really, really appreciate you. You're an inspiration, obviously very informative. You know what's going on around the world. I personally am a big fan, and appreciate you sharing your time with the audience listening in. I pray that God will continue to richly bless and use you for his glory and for the extension of his kingdom. Thank you for writing They Say We Are Infidels. I mean, it was an incredibly insightful book for me to read. May God continue to give you strength as you make a difference while there's yet time.
Thanks, Hank. That's really wonderful. I'm honored to be part of your program and honored to follow your ministry as well.
Thank you, Mindy. And, you know, for everybody listening in, you can go to iTunes and leave a review. Certainly share these podcasts with other people. And you can find Mindy's book at equip.org on the web. They Say We Are Infidels. It's an absolute must read. I've actually read the book more than once. It's riveting. And you are, as it were, traveling with Mindy to places that most of us will never go to. So if you have a chance, pick up They Say We Are Infidels. We make it available for anyone who supports the ministry of the Christian Research Institute. So you can find it on the web at equip.org. If you support our ministry, we'll send the book out to you. Another interesting and informative conversation with a very influential voice, not only in Christianity, but in the world in general. Pray for Mindy. She has courage, unusual courage, and as a result of her courage, she's able to give us a perspective that most of us would not have apart from that courage. So pray for Mindy and for her family, and thanks for tuning in to this particular edition of Hank Unplugged. Look forward to the next one with great anticipation. All of them are fun. So long for now.